Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there and welcome to Stock Club, a podcast brought to you by My Wall Street. I'm Mike and joining me in today's episode are Amory, Emmett and Rory from the My Wall Street analyst team. We're wrapping up the year that was with our most important stories from 2022. Emmett discusses 2022 in the context of some past market crashes. Amory breaks down what has gone wrong at Meta. And Rory looks at the whirlwind of a year Elon Musk has just gone through. Rory, Emmett, Amory, welcome to the last episode we're going to record of Stock Club for the year. We got a full house today, which is exciting. First time in a while. To kick us off, I just went back through our Spotify Wrapped, and there's some good stuff in there. I was heartily impressed. Do you know that 59% of our listeners actually follow the podcast? I thought that was great. Like, as in, over half of our listeners get a notification every time the four of us decide we have to rant for an hour.
But is that good, Mike? What, 59% never impressed any Irish mammy? If you came home and said, hey, I got my maths results, I got 59%, she would be fully unimpressed.
Oh, well, considering I don't follow one podcast, I thought it was impressive anyways.
Do you not follow your own podcast, Mike? Do you not at least have
I have to listen to it in real time and then I have to review it before it goes out. I've heard it enough.
Yeah.
Do you know which country was our number one listeners, our most listeners were from?
So most skulls, not yeah. Literally one person listening, you know, 30 times because they love Rory.
That could be it too. I'm not sure.
Is it Barbados?
It's not Barbados.
Is it Ireland?
Ireland, yeah. Barbados was the dark horse there. How many countries has Stock Club been played in this year?
102.
202.
60.
Showing my drastic.
80, drastic. 82.
I was joking, folks. I know there's not 202 countries. I just want that on record.
And how many minutes of Stock Club have gone out this year?
Too many.
Wow. How many minutes of Stock Club? Well, I suppose 50 episodes times 40 minutes is probably 2,000 minutes.
1,559 minutes.
What? That doesn't make any sense.
That's a whole lot of us.
Hold on a minute. 1,500 minutes. But if we do about 50 episodes in a year and each episode is 40 minutes, that's 2,000 minutes.
They're not always 40. We need to get
but how? There's a long, there's a big distance from 2,000 to. You said 1,500. Sorry, my Christmas brain is kicking in. Right,
okay. Also, okay. You don't realize how much of you we edit out in post.
Yeah. We know you don't listen to the podcast, so there's a lot of rants we just cut out.
Oh, good. Actually, that's actually a good thing. Yeah. No wonder we're number one in Barbados.
Okay, well, let's get into it for kind of our wrap-up of the year, or perhaps a post-mortem of the year, I think would be a better estimation of it. 2022 has seen the S&P 500 fall more than 25%, record inflation, war breakout, a rapid turnaround in economic policy from every central bank in the world, crypto capitulating, the world's richest man went off on one. The markets are down, the bonds are down, gold is down, crypto is down, property is down. You can't keep your money in cash because of inflation. Did I miss anything there? Emmett, for someone who has been fully invested throughout the dot-com crash and the great financial crisis, how does a year like 2022 stack up in comparison?
Well, at the very top level, you know, we're participating in a system that's a secular bull market, which is just fancy speak to say that that means the price of equities are more likely to increase than to go down. And any short-term decreases in prices are compensated by growth over the long term. So we're participating in a system that's a secular bull. And it's like, that's an indisputable fact. You know, the thing we're doing here, stock investing works over the long term, but you really need some grit to remember that at times like this. The dot-com bubble, which was kind of in the springtime of my investing life, came and went, the financial crisis and every downturn in history of America came and went, as well these days. You know, the downturn that we're witnessing and living through now will come and go. And, you know, there's absolutely no question that the market will eventually recover. So as I said at a recent Stock Club Live podcast, when you recall events like the dot-com bubble, you can either refer to facts or you can refer to feelings. So from a facts perspective, today as we record, the S&P 500 is about 3,817 points on December 27th last year, which is nearly a year ago. It was 4,766 points. So it's down 20% in the last year. And as you rightfully said, it fell about 25% at one point during the year. Now, in the year 2000, or in the dot-com bubble, the S&P 500 fell 51%. So from a facts perspective, the S&P 500 was far more maligned and destroyed at the turn of the millennium. But the S&P today has an entirely new characteristic. And it's that about 17.5%, which is like about 1/6 of the whole index, is defined by just 5 companies. That's incredible. Like an index, a ball of 500 businesses, 17% of the performance of that index is driven by just a handful of companies, Apple being top of the league, followed by Microsoft, Amazon, Berkshire, and Alphabet. So we have an index now that says the market is down 20% compared to this time a year ago. However, just 5 companies are driving the story, like hundreds of S&P 500 companies. I'm going to go out there and say the vast majority of them, probably 80% of them, are at 5-year lows. The volume of businesses that have gone down between 50 and 90% from their all-time high is just mind-boggling. And just before we went live, I was looking at Allbirds, who are makers of nice footwear, and they've fallen from a post-IPO price of $26 to $2 and change. And that, to me, was the story of 2022. Businesses that I like and admire have been just blasted, absolutely blasted. And it's masked by this S&P 500 story. You know, it's only down 20% thanks to those giant businesses. So the facts as defined by the S&P 500 have this subplot. Yeah, the S&P was down more than 20 years ago, but when you peel away the cream at the top of today, it's very, very similar storyboard. So again, from a facts perspective, and just speaking from a personal perspective, this year was tougher because I was 26 when the dot-com bubble burst, and I'm 48 now, so I have less runway. So just being factual about it, like, it's when you're 26 and the market does a downturn, it's, you know, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's fine. You can get on with it during the springtime of, well, pretty much everything. But from a feelings perspective, for me, the dot-com bubble was way worse. It was way worse. It was absolutely brutal. Every day, Yahoo Finance was giving a roll call of businesses that had gone under, a lot of which I was invested in. And it's, I suppose, again, I said at our live event that a dictionary writer or maker, Samuel Johnson, said that the chains of habit are too weak to be felt until they're too strong to be broken. In fact, I think the exact quote was, "The diminutive chains of habit are seldom heavy enough to be felt until they're too strong to be broken." But in more recent times, Warren Buffett said, you know, chains of habit are too light to be felt until they're too heavy to be broken. And that quote became attributed to him. And the reason I refer to that now is that during the dot-com bubble and post burst, I just kept investing and kept investing and kept investing. And just the way most people, when they wake up in the morning, don't think about having to brush their teeth or brush their teeth before they go to bed, that's you know, the habits embedded in my life where I just keep investing through thick and thin and it works. So yeah, how does it feel? Well, the feeling it is, the dot-com bubble felt worst from a facts perspective. Despite what the S&P 500 is saying, I'd say it's even Stevens.
Good man. Thanks very much for that. So we're kind of going to look at everyone's story of the year for this pod. And I think Anne-Marie, she's established herself as the social media expert at My Wall Street over the past year, 2 years. So the obvious go-to here is for Facebook. And it's definitely been one of the most prominent stories, Facebook or Meta, however you so choose. There's been an incredible destruction of value here in a very short space of time. The company hit all-time highs in September of 2021. The next month, we had the rebrand to Meta. And fast forward to now, the company's down about 70% since and lost about $750 billion in market cap. In fact, you have to go back as far as 2016 to see the stock at similar levels. Anne-Marie, simple question to start you out. Where has it all gone wrong here?
Oof. Hard one, but it's probably like the three things, which is the adpocalypse, you know, getting iOS 14.5, the loss of IDFA tracking. Central products seem to be in kind of perpetual decline here, with Instagram and Facebook have pretty much fallen out of favor with teenagers. And then, you know, I think like the doubling down of the metaverse product has spooked investors, but I think it's also starting to spook staff from Meta itself, which, you know, it's always concerning to see. I think on the first point, the adpocalypse, like that kicked off, gosh, in like 2021, we knew it was going to be pretty bad. Like before even IDFA went away, we continually heard Meta discuss, you know, we don't think this is fair to small businesses. That was kind of their veiled reaction, which really was them saying, this is not going to be good for our business. They took out billboards in major cities. They took out a full page ad in the New York Times. It was a big talking point for them. I even think like with that level of preparedness, they don't seem to have been anticipating how bad it was going to be. I mean, like quarter after quarter, we continually hear Zuckerberg say, continue to feel the impacts of IDFA changes. Which is just like astounding. And it's really kind of gutted Meta's ability to be this like great leader in advertising. And I think kind of the loss of targeted advertising is forcing many advertisers to reconsider where they're spending. I think they're sending money now elsewhere just because there's just a loss of effectiveness, really. And we discussed this last week or 2 weeks ago. This problem is only going to get worse if that EU ruling goes through, which will essentially dictate that Facebook and Instagram will need to be in line with GDPR, which as of currently, they are not in line because they use this loophole that a lot of, you know, tech companies do, where they basically argue, oh, we need to be able to collect data to run our product. So Facebook likes to say, oh, we must be able to have targeted advertising in order to make money, in order to sustain the site. It seems like the EU is kind of running out of patience with this sort of model. So that will make it even harder for Facebook to effectively sell targeted advertising. That kind of means that we're moving more and more almost to like a traditional advertisement model where like it has to be driven by content, right? Like your advertising needs to be pretty interesting. It's very difficult, I think, for Meta to maybe pull off that transition, because I think under that type of advertising model, you need to have the eyeballs, right? You need to have people's attention. I read a really interesting article in TechCrunch, which basically it was one of their marketing agencies talked about that in a content recommendation model, there's just not as much real estate for traditional ads because it just seems more intrusive. And also there just isn't the time to put them in. And that means that you really do have to get creative, and, you know, you can't allow your advertisement to just be subpar and be like, oh, it's fine because the targeting will make up for it. And as of right now, I really can't see Facebook or Instagram being primed to make that transition. It just reminds me a lot of something we talked about at some point this year, where TikTok, when they go to advertisers to talk to them about how to effectively use the site, they say, do not make advertisements, make TikToks. You know, you want your content to be so good, it just flows right into the organic feed and people might not even notice it's there. You know, if you want an example of that, go look at Ryanair, who essentially just hires teenagers and tells them, make whatever you want, which is how you end up with this very cheeky, hilarious, over-the-top content. But I would say that that's had a really important impact on even just getting Ryanair's name out there to people who might not be aware of them, because pretty much anyone outside of the European market might not be familiar with them. You hear a lot of Americans talking about them now. And I think it becomes that thing of they're like, oh, the next time I'm in Europe and I want to fly from one country to the next, I'll just use Ryanair because I've heard of them. I have that name recognition. I think like Meta is just trying to turn the wheels to get into this market. You know, we saw them last quarter discuss, oh, we're going to introduce a creator marketplace, which will help brands partner with, you know, significant people on Instagram or on Facebook, which is trying to get them the more, oh, this is an organic ad type type market, but I just, the horse might already run. Like, it, you know, it might be too late. And then we have the kind of secondary point, which is like, it doesn't matter if they can fix the advertisement model, because I'm pretty sure that the central products are in decline. I've never seen a company fumble as bad as Facebook has fumbled Instagram. Like, they just became very panicked when TikTok came out, which is reasonable. But it meant that they just walked away completely from photos. I've talked about this kind of at length this year. And they tried to develop Reels to compete with TikTok, but it's just a subpar product. I don't think you ever want to be trying to chase the market. You know, you want the market to come to you. You want to be anticipating things. I think that the development of Reels in Meta was very reactionary, and you can kind of tell. And that kind of seems to be their last hope. They talk about it a lot on calls where they say, oh, we're beginning to see, you know, advertisement and e-commerce pick up on Reels. But, you know, we had that Creators X Reels State of the Union 2022 leaked to, I believe, the Wall Street Journal in August. And it basically said that, like, Reels is just completely dwarfed by TikTok. It's something like users spend 10x the amount of time on TikTok than they do on Reels. And they have consistently for the last couple of months seen engagement on Reels fall. So, like, I don't think it's going to be this big disruptive force that they hope it's going to be. So then it's that idea of, even again, even if they can tilt and go to creative ads, you know, they don't need targeting. They, like, don't have a product to be able to effectively use that type of advertising. That being said, I originally did all this research a couple weeks ago, and we were kind of, you know, this has been this big thing of, oh, you know, Meta's products are in decline. But, like, the social media landscape in the last 2 weeks has changed dramatically, where we have, you know, like, is Twitter just going to combust? Because, like, there are rumors like Elon Musk might just declare bankruptcy, throw the whole thing out, call it a loss, write off his investment. And, like, if that were to happen, like, what would happen to Twitter? Would the site just go under? Or, you know, what would happen to the ability to sell ads, or, you know, whatever? So then it's that thing of, okay, if Twitter goes away, that's one thing. And then we have, you know, TikTok is probably going to be banned for American federal employees. It looks like that bill has bipartisan support. It's probably going to make its way through before the end of this legislative calendar. I wouldn't be surprised to see politicians coming back and trying to expand that further and saying, hey, we want TikTok to be banned for all Americans. We want TikTok to be forced to effectively store their data with another third party in the United States, something like that. And a restriction like that could, like, I don't know, maybe that's a miracle. Maybe Meta will be left as the only social media product still standing. So yeah, that might be a funny twist we see, or maybe we'll finally see a new social media company.
Do any of you guys remember a TV advert? I think it was 1980s, which means none of you will remember. And it was the Pepsi Challenge. Does that ring a bell?
I've heard of the Pepsi Challenge, but I can't remember seeing it.
Well, there was a kind of a TV advert campaign where there was two glasses of cola in supermarkets.
Oh, the blind taste test. Yeah,
the blind taste test. And not only was it shown on TV, but it was also in your local supermarket or grocery store, if you're in America, where they had two glasses of cola and then a kind of the can covered. So you tasted drink A and drink B to identify the one that tasted better. Well, in the taste test was a Pepsi advert campaign that something like 9 out of 10 tasters preferred Pepsi, and they'd unveil the two cans, and sure enough, it was Pepsi 9 out of 10 times, and the other one was Coca-Cola. It was a very direct duopolistic, I guess, marketing campaign. But it was funny, a few years later, New Scientist, as I push my glasses up my nose and do a kind of a horn-rimmed glasses up my nose, New Scientist did a piece that said that when you analyze taste, you get the greatest hit from the first note, which is the real sugary thing. But for overall pleasure, Coca-Cola was probably the winner because it had a longer half-life of flavor. And it went into a full analysis of why that actual taste test was flawed, or at least was very much biased for Pepsi, who had front-loaded the flavor hit. Now, when I think of social media, I think that Twitter is like Coca-Cola. The pleasure has a longer half-life. The utility just burns there in the background. But the utility that Instagram and friends, if you like, provided was analogous to me, like Pepsi Cola, where it gives you the hit, you open it, you see these beautiful pictures of somebody proposing on a boat in the middle of a lagoon, or you're zooming in and it falls back, but it's real instantaneous hit. But the kind of ultimate utilitarian purpose of social media was, I think, absolutely on the bullseye with Twitter. Now, I don't like using the past tense because Twitter is just there. It's just constant burning news source, and all the others are not quite that. And that's why I think they're like Pepsi, and why Twitter is like the Coca-Cola of social media.
Very good. I wasn't sure where that was going at the start.
Neither was I.
You brought it back. we're going to get into Twitter in a bit. So I'll leave off that for a small bit. But so Anne-Marie, you outlined three major threats to Facebook: TikTok, the ad tracking, and the metaverse money hole. Out of all these three, which do you think might cause the most long-term damage to the company?
I think it's the ads and the products declining, but I think those issues are really intertwined. You know, I think users began to leave, ad revenue began to fall because of that, and then IDFA tracking, and then Meta began to emulate TikTok, which made users more annoyed, and you know, they left quicker. And then things just kind of got even worse. Like, I see them kind of going round and round in a bit of a cycle there. And I think like that is more disastrous than the metaverse development, because like you could pull off the metaverse and like the huge amount of money they spend on it if they could continue with some sort of revenue growth. Whereas I think the revenue growth is starting to stall, and it's causing people to panic a little bit because they're saying, okay, top line growth is stalling, and also they're pouring cash into something else. And it just kind of makes you think, oh, I thought maybe we would have a 10-year horizon on this project, and now it seems like it's getting closer and closer and closer to us. So I think that is the biggest concern. It's just, you know, it's Google spends an awful lot of money on little offshoot projects and just can basically write it off in its investor presentations because it continues to bring in so much money that I think people are like, oh, it's whatever. If you have billions of dollars in cash, I suppose you can waste some of it.
Yeah. Well, I think Google, Rory, you always raise this point as well, that Google shareholders, you know, if Sergey Brin and Larry Page want to do their moonshots, just do it with their own money and do it in another company. Isn't that kind of the case?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of an argument to put up against Alphabet as a conglomerate, though a lot of shareholders kind of use the moonshots as kind of one of the reasons to get into the stock as well. So it is, you know, it comes around just depending on who you're asking.
I don't think the argument to let Zuckerberg go off and spend 40 billion quid on the metaverse is going to be too strong a suggestion. But speaking of Zuckerberg, and he's been the CEO probably with the most power over a company of this size, I think maybe ever. Is there ever a situation, do you think, Anne-Marie, that he could be ousted as CEO?
I mean, because of the stock class structure, he's the majority shareholder, so he cannot like be removed. No one can get in there and throw him out. There was a rumor that cropped up a few weeks ago that he might step down. That was like a big leak that came out that has been denied. And I was thinking if that were to happen, we would get maybe, yeah, like a situation Rory just discussed of like, maybe they would spin off the metaverse part and just like Zuckerberg could go over there and deal with that since it seems to be his real passion project. And then they would just allow the kind of dinosaur products to be ticking over in the background. You know, the stock would maybe move away from growth and just be kind of become an old world player, you know, maybe get a bit of a dividend and that type of thing. You know, I could see that happening. But I really do think like Mark is so important to the direction of the company. We saw recently like one of the metaverse's like biggest developers, he just stepped down and he publicly released his resignation letter. And it seemed that a lot of kind of his reasoning for getting tired, he'd been in the business for like 10 or 12 years, like a significant chunk of time. And it just seemed like kind of Mark's underlying direction was annoying him. And that seemed to be why he felt the need to go. I often look back to when Sheryl Sandberg decided to step down to be a real indication of where Mark was heading, because she basically publicly said there is no longer a position for her there. She said she couldn't see a place for herself within the metaverse. And that's, you know, pretty shocking because she is so instrumental and important to Meta becoming this giant cash generator. You know, she effectively created the advertisement market within Facebook and Instagram. And so to see that she, you know, was basically like, well, there's no job for me here anymore, it tells me that, you know, Meta overall is going to move away from ads, but also will be moving away from its central products and isn't all that interested in developing them anymore, which, you know, is a big concern if that is, you know, the initial reason that you were interested in the stock.
Yeah. And zooming out then to social media as a whole, it's not just Facebook or Meta that's been suffering. Snap is down. Snap's been decimated in the last year. Pinterest is down heavy. Twitter is twittering, I guess, doing whatever the hell that is. Even TikTok, which was kind of seen as this overarching presence in the whole industry that's sucking up all the eyeballs. That even revised down its guidance this year as well. Why is social media getting hit so hard as an industry?
I think there's definitely like a macroeconomic wind blowing there. You know, typically for most businesses, the first thing they cut when they're starting to feel the pinch is marketing budgets. So I do think probably there's just less money floating around for them to snap up. But, you know, it's the things that we mentioned earlier. It's the change within the ad game, the loss of IDFA tracking. I think because Snapchat keeps going on about that as well. They've had an awful time trying to do ads in the kind of post iOS 14.5 world. But I also think it's just like the style of advertising is changing and people are trying to find their footing in that market. You know, I think moving forward, we need to be looking for people who are good at doing ads that are like subtle, innovative, you know, flexible, are able to fit into kind of interesting spaces. You know, you discussed Pinterest there, and actually like Pinterest tends to get lumped in as a social media ever since like we've started talking about them. We try and highlight the fact that it is actually kind of a subtle e-commerce player. And in last quarter, they actually beat on ad revenue. And I think it's because their ability to place ads within like the search function is very powerful. It's something like 87% of Pinterest users have purchased something they saw on Pinterest. So it just, you know, people are just in a better mindset to be advertised to. We more and more hear about the fact that like Gen Z people, kids who have grown up with the internet are almost impossible to advertise to because they've become immune because they're so used to seeing it on their feeds all the time that it almost has no impact. So, you know, that might place a lot of power in platforms like this where people are somewhat already looking for something. And this is, you know, even something that we discussed last week within the context of Amazon. Amazon just released their like organic discovery shopping feed, which is meant to kind of emulate the experience you would have on Pinterest or TikTok. You know, it's basically like the online version of window shopping. You don't know what you need. You go on the Amazon app. You can have a look through all of these kind of pictures and videos, or you can, you know, follow your favorite creators who might have an Amazon partnership. And over time, their algorithm is going to learn the type of stuff you're interested in and then kind of suggest new and innovative products you might not have thought of. That might be kind of the great workaround for the adpocalypse, because it's like, it's not advertising, it's content, but it is also advertising. You know, we're essentially going back to QVC. It's just on social media. And that is actually something that's been highly, highly successful in the East within Japan, Korea, and China. You see huge live streaming stars who all they do all day is essentially advertise products and sell them to people. But people are obsessed with the social media star. They're obsessed with a certain type of product. And they watch that content all the time. It's really interesting. And it's actually something that we initially discussed like 2 years ago within the context of Clubhouse, because they were built on Agora, and Agora was a company that specialized in live streaming. And so much of Agora's argument for their ability to grow within the West was, hey, this shopping live streaming is eventually going to come here. I don't know if that is going to be true. Like, I don't know if that's going to be a huge industry, but I do think this kind of subtlety, skirting around advertising, making e-commerce shopping more of an experience could be a beneficial way for these players. Other than that, like, I think we're going to see a fair amount of ads probably move into like connected TV, traditional TV, and really kind of put the ball more into like a quality content platform. You know, I think a player like the New York Times or NerdWallet doesn't have to necessarily be tracking its users and developing these really detailed profiles of them, because I think the New York Times basically just says, well, if a person is paying and subscribed to the New York Times, you know approximately what they're like. And I think that that will maybe make it a little bit easier for them to sell ads moving forward. But yeah, for the social media game, I think they're going to have to be leaning more into e-commerce and more into creative advertising.
When the whole thing is being cracked on what
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What I mean by that is that you are really only being served up ads for things that interest you. I think it's really going to utterly change the game, because you know, for us now, watching TV, linear TV, ads are a nuisance. Like, they just get in the way. But if it is, in fact, interrupting to show you things that through whatever means they know you need or want, you know, you'll watch your adverts, you know. But again, going back to the 80s, a kid in the cinema, you'd watch the ads with as much interest as the movie because it was part of the entertainment. And of course, we ended up punch drunk with adverts. And then, you know, we're blind now to TV ads. They just, we either fast forward through them or hit the mute button. But when those ads are really talking about the things you want, like, hey, do you need new valves for your Fender amplifier? And you're like, wow, these guys totally know. Yes, I do. Take my money. So there's definitely, I think we will hit a point where your needs are served up to you before perhaps you even realize you need them. A couple of years ago, when we had just founded a business, I met with Professor Barry Smith, who at the time, I think, was the head of the School of Computer Science in UCD and is a recognized global expert in recommender systems right through to this day. And Barry at the time, I think at the time he was even advisor to Netflix, who wanted to kind of know that if you like watching the movie Dumb and Dumber, you'll actually enjoy a wartime movie, which were kind of very tenuous links when you look at it on paper. Or like, if you're a fan of Metallica, you'll also like Kylie Minogue and these very strange things, which when you see them written down, you're like, no, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But it was, he said that Amazon had built a recommender system that you'd see stuff on your Amazon page that looked totally out of context. So if you went in to buy a book on dividend investing, you'd see like a vegetable slicer. And the whole, you know, down at the bottom. And the whole logic there was that it wasn't to suggest, hey, guess what, you need to buy a vegetable slicer today. It was to tell you that you can buy a vegetable slicer and that they had enough information to recognize that you're at a stage of life where vegetable slicers are, you know, more relevant than, I don't know, like bungee rope. So like, so the whole point is that the speed of insights that are building through either AI assist or other methods really will bring us to a point where we'll be shown ads for things we want before we actually realize we want them.
I see Rory there in the corner being like, is that not what everyone's Amazon page looks like? Cooking equipment, investing books, knives.
Yeah, mine's mostly just recipe books.
I just thought that was the homepage.
Amazon is the worst though when they don't realize that like, whatever you just bought was most definitely a one-time purchase. You know, you like buy a toilet seat and then they will send you an ad like 2 weeks later being like, look at more toilet seats. And you're like, I only have one toilet. It's okay. I don't need more. Like,
it's interesting to see like so much change already happen and then anticipating so much more for ads in 2023. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely going to be an exciting area to be watching. Moving on then, we have to talk about the, I don't know, is downfall a bit early to say? Maybe we're going to say that is.
It looks like he's in the middle of a downfall right now.
Yeah. Anyway. The spiral, maybe, of Elon Musk.
I have a theory. Go on, please. This whole thing has been, he's been trying to get Time Magazine Man of the Year. And he saw what Zelensky was doing in Ukraine and thought, I'm really going to have to up my game here if I want to take on this guy.
It would feed the kind of megalomania of the whole situation, I think.
Certainly.
Yeah. But he hasn't been out of the headlines for more than 5 minutes, and he's kind of trying to guarantee that as well, which would fit to your theory as well, Rory. Do you think buying Twitter was a good idea for the CEO of the largest car company in the world, Rory?
So, it really doesn't look like it was. Obviously now, well, by the time this goes out, he could not be running Twitter if that's depending on what he does with these poll results that he's promised to abide by.
Yeah. I think he's going to have a poll out tomorrow morning. What songs to wear?
I see he's saying now he's going to step down as CEO, but like just run the software and the engineering side, which does sound like he's copping out of this whole actually going to run it. But yeah, look, obviously Musk also runs Tesla, one of the biggest, some would say, one of the most important businesses in the world right now. He also runs SpaceX, probably one of the most important private companies in the world right now. You know, a company that has the potential to vastly change the course of human history. And And that's just for starters. He's got various other projects going on, Starlink and the Boring Company, and probably loads more that we haven't even discussed. And yet, for some weird reason, he's decided he wants to run Twitter as well. You know, I like, he's a divisive character. He's got his fair share of hardcore fans and his fair share of haters. But I don't think anyone could argue that this takeover has gone well up to this point. I mean, if we go back a long way, just back to his motivations at the start, it does seem like a rather knee-jerk reaction to offer to buy a company for $44 billion just because a parody account that you like was banned.
Well, I think the real reason is he wanted to get the Elon Jet account removed.
Yeah, well, we know that now. No one's real motivations were. Yeah, very expensive. I mean, I think that guy offered him, he said he'd take it down for like 50 grand. That would have been a much better use of his money. Yeah, I mean, look, at the time, you know, as Anne-Marie's already pointed out, digital marketing at the time was already in a terrible state. Apple's new tracking policies had hit some of the more successful platforms. Twitter itself was not one of the more successful platforms at the time. It was struggling and racing to release new products to try and generate new revenue streams. His timing really couldn't have been worse. I mean, if he'd wanted Twitter, he probably could have picked it up for a fraction of the $44 billion if he kind of just waited a few months. And I suppose you have to give Twitter's management some credit for seeing that and selling up at the time. And of course, we had the whole summer off a kind of back and forth over whether this deal was going to go through or not. It doesn't really give you much faith in, I suppose, his greater vision of the company when he's trying to pull out of a deal one week and then kind of telling us all how great it's going to be once he figures out he's forced to actually buy it.
It's going to be WeChat, trust me.
Yeah.
It's all part of what, the super X company?
Yeah, the X.com. Yeah, there's always this kind of idea of his bigger vision in mind, but you know, just off the bat, the problem started. Companies spend money on advertising on Twitter, and one of the biggest kind of sectors that spends that money is automakers. So, you know, right away, you're going to start seeing the automakers start pulling out of advertising because they're not going to want to give potentially sensitive data to their biggest competitor. Then you go fire half your staff, a lot of whom worked in kind of content moderation. And it wasn't like these seemed to be some sort of like well-planned series of layoffs, you know, taking into account kind of strategic priorities and platform safety. It was literally like having engineers print off code that they've written in the last few months and then firing those who'd written the least. Then he's trying to do open letters to the ads industry, promising, you know, that Twitter won't become a free-for-all hellscape, I think is the word he used. But the truth is, like, they were already struggling to compete in the digital marketing space, and advertisers were probably, you know, happy enough to be given an excuse to cut the cord. And the big problem with that, obviously, is that if they go away and they can find better returns somewhere else, you're never going to get them back. Now, according to Elon, the company's losing $4 million a day. He spent $44 billion on the business. There's going to be spending about $1 billion a year in interest to service those loans. Their subscription service, Twitter Blue, was a disaster that led to a major pharmaceutical company losing $30 billion in market cap after a verified account from them, which was obviously fake, posted that they were going to give away free insulin from now on. So, I mean, do we need to go on? I don't think it's been a good idea. I think it's what I'm trying to get to.
You could have just said no, saved us all 10 minutes.
That's true. Brevity is not my specialty.
No, verbosity all the way. We've always talked about the cult of Musk, and for a long time, Tesla's valuation was intrinsically linked to its CEO. With the stock down more than 60% this year, how much of this drop can be attributed to Musk's antics?
Well, I think considering the year that's in it, it's probably unfair to assign any one thing to a declining share price. You know, there have been unprecedented inflation, global supply chain issues, spiraling shipping costs, you know, a war. And then on top of that, Tesla has had its own issues, particularly in terms of Chinese operations, where the zero COVID policy has really kind of hampered their ability to produce cars. But I mean, we saw today it's Tesla shares are down, I think 59% from the time you made that announcement. That's more than twice any of the other major automakers, and about six times the S&P in that space and time. So, you know, there definitely is something to it. And you know, if I was a shareholder personally, I would worry that he's just a little not focused on Tesla right now, just based on the kind of frequency of his tweeting. And, you know, he's a CEO. He's got loads of people who are intelligent working under themselves. But at the same time, he has promoted himself as being very important to Tesla's operations. You know, he's the guy who sleeps on the factory floor and makes sure the work gets done. And the Tesla brand is very much aligned with Musk too. He's the fact that he's selling millions of shares, that's going to damage investor confidence. And moreover, he's putting himself in a lot of positions now, which is going to make him very unpopular. Not that that's something that he hasn't shied away from in the past, but you know, he's getting now in the face of like regulators all over the world. You know, the European Union already warned him. He's had online spats with various politicians. And he's on a practical basis as well. Tesla as a company is one that's very much reliant on China, both in terms of its production and its for its customers. And, you know, Musk has said he's bringing free speech to Twitter. That's, you know, not particularly in line with the policies of the Chinese government, who, you know, there have been cases in the past where the Chinese government has strong-armed companies that they knew were reliant on their markets. You know, we look at Apple, we look at the NBA, major movie studios have all had to kind of apologize or do something. So I'm wondering whether he may have just bit off a bit too much for himself to chew here, and he's probably risked up Tesla quite a lot in being in control of this business.
Yeah, could be a lot of conflicts of interest there. Emmett, you've been a long-term Tesla investor. How do you feel about Musk's antics?
You know, not impressed like most people, but last night I was reading an article on CNET, which used to be a huge online resource, and I don't know, I haven't seen it so much these days. In fact, it was flagged to me by futurism.com, which is quite an interesting daily email. It's a bit out there, but still it hits the nail on the head now and again. But anyway, it was saying that Tesla customers are getting turned off by Elon Musk's Twitter meltdowns. And that according to the piece, Tesla salespeople say, and I don't quantify it, but quote, a lot of customers are canceling reservations for a car and not signing new leases because of Musk's Twitter behavior. So, you know, I was initially thought, well, you know, the problem is confined to the walls of Twitter, and sure, Musk's attention cannot be on all businesses at once. But it's quite interesting to see it now creep, or at least being reported that that his behavior is really influencing people's buying behaviors, which for me, as I was reflecting on the piece, it kind of was a further proof point that people need to believe in the businesses with which they're doing business. And, you know, Ben and Jerry's is a great example of an ice cream company, but they have spent their lives saying, save the planet, stop the icebergs melting. You know, if it's melted, it's ruined, and it's fair trade. And that kind of seeps into your consciousness, which means you kind of feel you're doing good when you eat a liter of fish food, you know? Yeah. But anyway, so I kind of, I do think that the scope creep, if you like, of Elon's behavior is larger than certainly I first thought of, especially now that we see his other businesses allegedly getting it in the neck.
Has Ben and Jerry's ever called themselves the nice cream company? Because that would be I need to sell them that, I think.
Trademark that right away.
This is the official copyright here, just in case it comes out after.
Ice cream is a big business, and there was a movie, The Ice Cream Wars, about how Haagen-Dazs and Ben and Jerry's were at each other's throats for years. But I saw Tyra Banks. You know Tyra Banks. She has an ice cream company now, which she was launching forever, because I was keeping an eye on it, and it was called Smize. And the concept was that you smile with your eyes. And I presume when you're eating ice cream, you're smiling with your eyes. But the ice cream duopoly. There's so many duopolies in FMCG. I think it's just another one. Anyway, a subject for another podcast.
I think so. A question for Ollie. So yeah, quick yes or no. Do you think Twitter exists this time next year?
I think that it will exist because it's got a real dedicated following. You know, news junkies love Twitter and they go there for that text-based news. Whether he'll still be there, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I would agree with what Rory said. I think like the form of microblogging that Twitter has is so popular and it really doesn't have any competitors. So I think like even if Musk were to like back out, push the company into bankruptcy, something like that, like someone would come in and pick up the pieces. Like I just think the brand is too valuable.
Yeah, I think it'll be around. I'd have little doubt it'll be around. Now, I didn't realize, Mike, you were telling me recently he stuffed it with a whole pile of debt.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not a good look, as you would say, but I don't know. Yeah, I think it'll be around. Sure, he's just voted himself off the platform. He knew everybody was going to vote him out. So, yeah,
I think he did. I actually think he was shocked when that happened.
Yeah, I kind of think he was too.
Because really? Did you see the video of him coming out on the Dave Chappelle show and like everyone booing him, and he looks genuinely shocked.
But he does these things with the Twitter polls. Like, do you remember when he was talking about selling shares and stuff? Like he makes a decision, then does a Twitter poll and it agrees with him. And he's like, oh, look at me. I'm man of the people. I think he's already looking for a new CEO. Mm. Yeah. Right.
Interesting. But I suppose when a poll aligns with your own beliefs, where I saw this poll and went, no, he's got to leave the business. He's come in, he's disrupted, he's done his piece, albeit in a very concentrated beam width. He went in and did the complete turnaround job in a full theatrical display. I was like, yeah, he's got to go, and he knows he's got to go. I'd be surprised if he was surprised. But then when you talk about that Dave Chappelle show, I'm like, oh, interesting. Maybe his self-awareness really is in the floor.
Yeah, he initially did try and walk it back by saying that the poll, he wanted to like in the future only let people who paid for the blue check marks vote in elections, which sounds very much like the voting policy of the 18th century. So I don't think he realized. Yeah, I think he thought he was really popular. I think he's in a bit of an echo chamber.
Anne-Marie, you're going to have to give us a lecture on the voting policies of 18th century. Wow, let's watch our listenership numbers crater that week.
Okay, so every year with these kind of wrap-up pods, we get our crystal ball out, we make some predictions for the year ahead. Every year they turn out to make us look pretty foolish, but we do it anyways, and we're going to do that as well this year. So just to set us up for the crystal ball predictions of 2022. We're going to look back on last year. Rory, this is a real blast from the past here. You predicted that Square, it now has a different name. It's called Block now. would buy the NFT platform OpenSea. So that just shows where investors' minds were at the time.
That didn't happen.
No. Emmett, you kind of went very off the board here and you went for a company called Quidel to grow 32% in the year. That didn't happen. It's down 39%. Anne-Marie, you said 2022 would be the year of Planet Fitness and predicted it would grow 50%. Neither of those things happened. And I didn't have a prediction. If I did, it was
convenient.
That's very convenient that you didn't have a prediction.
Yeah, there's no evidence of it.
If you make your prediction now for last year, what do you think will happen?
I think the S&P 500 will fall 16.73%.
Don't be ridiculous, Mike.
Stocks don't go down, you feel.
Mike, did you not say something about Unity last year?
Yeah, I might have said somebody would try to buy Unity, Facebook or Microsoft.
Yeah.
Not exactly on the money. Okay, so with our reputations intact and our predictive powers at their full limits, Emmett, what is your prediction for 2023?
Mike, you very conveniently overlooked the previous two convictions predictions.
Convictions.
My previous two convictions were on the money, but anyway, let's move on. So yeah, well, I'm going to vary from what I said at our livestock club event, not in any way. In any way, because I've changed my mind at that live recording, but because there were a lot of people who paid to attend the event or who have subscribed to Horizon, and I don't think it's fair just to put out there something that people have subscribed here. But I said on the live event that a particular favorite investment of mine was going to grow very significantly in the year ahead. In fact, I'm so convinced of it that it was my last buy in Horizon a week or two ago. And on that, why not buy Horizon for a loved one, folks? Always be selling. Okay, so for this podcast, I don't like betting that something will go down. Not because it doesn't happen, it happens every day, but because I don't want to be proven right with a negative outcome when there are so many things in this world to be optimistic about. And, you know, every day I wake up optimistic and today is no different. And I was going to go for a prediction relating to Invisalign maker Align, and I was nearly bullish on Align, but found some data at the tail end of my research that kind of forced me to change course, which is horrible when it happens. You know, you've really gotten to a place and you've put hours into something and then you go, oh, anyway, well, I'm not going to make it about a line. I'm going to make it about a business that I'm pretty sure we've never discussed on the podcast, and it's called Docebo. Do you guys know?
Docebo. I looked at that years ago. I don't think it ever came to the podcast. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so just a numbers level, Docebo is a billion-dollar business. It's profitable. Last winter, when everything was flying high, it was $84 a pop, and now it's about $32 a pop. So Docebo, what is it? Well, it's a Canadian business in the LMS, learning management services. Is it learning management services?
Systems,
correct. Sorry, learning management systems. And they're a pretty big business. I said $1 billion, 800 employees, 8 offices around the world. And they have a lot of giant companies who use their LMS for their companies. For example, AWS, L'Oreal, Heineken, you know, big giant brands use their system for learning and development inside companies. It's a really efficient business. It's extremely efficient. And when you look at its free cash flow, or more to the point, total ARR, annual recurring revenue, it's been that beautiful xylophone shape that you look for in not quite exponential growth. That's an overused expression, mathematically inaccurate, but anyway, that shape that people think is exponential. And it's growing at twice the speed of the other LMS industry. And for example, like last year, it had a recurring subscription revenue of something like $104 million, which was up 66% on the year before. And by September of this year, they had exceeded that amount. So the business is still growing. So I'm going to predict that the trend is indeed our friend here, and that Docebo will increase in value by something between 50 and 70% at some point in 2023, which, when you look at the predictions for the macro market in 2023, is very, very bullish. But this business has bottomed out like every other stock, and virtually every metric in there is getting better and better. So I'm going to just basically put a bullish green thumbs up on Docebo, a stock that, until I started researching for this podcast last night, I hadn't given a whole lot of attention to. It's on one of my many watch lists, and I just think it's a good one for the year ahead.
Perfect. Thanks, Emmett. Rory, do you have a prediction for 2023?
Yeah, I'll do one that's a kind of fun one based on what we already know and one thing that I personally hope. And that is that a major company, and I think it's probably going to be Amazon, will acquire or attempt to acquire Peloton. We know that the company was being looked at by a number of kind of suitors at the start of last year. Around this time, obviously, the stock was down quite significantly from its all-time highs. The CEO was stepping down. They'd had this major pull forward in demand during the pandemic, which just didn't continue when the world opened up. Since then, they've had serious inventory issues. They've been trying to shift that inventory. They brought in a new CEO who is now totally focused on kind of the software and content element of the business. They're really moving away from hardware. They've come up with several different initiatives to try and get more of those bikes into the homes, including selling some of their models on Amazon, which they'd never done before. I think the new CEO basically was put in there to make this company a more attractive acquisition. So there's a few names out there, Apple, Nike, potentially Disney. But we've seen over the year how Amazon has not hesitated to spend money when it sees a good deal on the table. And I think it may happen in 2023 for them.
Very good. Anne-Marie, your prediction for 2023?
Yeah, I kind of want to pitch a concept of stocks that I've labeled the beloved millennial collection. And this is essentially an idea of typically when we're in tough macroeconomic conditions, we tend to see luxury brands do quite well because rich people are just unaffected by everything. A good example of that was the Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy group. They were up like 19% last quarter for revenue. They basically said that they've seen a huge surge in spending in Paris and New York, and you know, basically like all is well in that realm of the world. But I have kind of noticed there's this like secondary class of, they're not quite luxury companies, but they are like middle class, high end. And the three that I kind of want to highlight is Lululemon, Lovesac, and Yeti. Lululemon last quarter had sales growth of 28%. Lovesac in Q2 had 46% sales growth. That has kind of tempered down a bit because obviously they sell couches, and a couch is quite a big investment, and that tends to be, their sales tend to be tied to homeownership. And so in Q3, their sales were only up 15.5%, but still to have such significant growth at the beginning of this year is quite impressive. And then Yeti, which is, they sell like coolers, water bottles, thermoses, that type of thing, had 20% growth last quarter. It's very interesting to see them kind of just cruise on by. They're all experiencing a little bit of margin pressure due to freight expenses, but pretty much all of them have said that this should resolve by the end of this year, which will, you know, give some margin relief that has some investors worried. Yeah, so I think collectively they will do pretty well in the next year or two. If I had to pick maybe one of them, I would lean more towards Yeti, because I think, you know, selling water bottles and thermoses, which have become a massive part of their revenue growth, is pretty easy in the current conditions rather than, you know, trying to sell a $1,000, $2,000 couch. Yeah. And all, with the exception of Lululemon, both Lovesac and Yeti are down a lot this year. So, you know, I think they might have a nice bounce back. So, yeah.
It's interesting. We should start a ETF.
Yeah.
You can have like the Gen Y as a ticker, GENY.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Good stuff. Thanks for all those predictions, lads. And thank you for being part of Stock Club for 2022. And for everyone out there listening as well, thank you very much. I don't have the numbers for that. In all 82 countries you're listening from, is what I was supposed to say. That's it for today's show. Remember, if you have any questions you'd like answered or elevator pitches you'd like us to tackle, make sure to get in touch. You can find us on Twitter at MyWallStreetHQ, on TikTok at MyWallStreet, or simply just email us on pod@MyWallStreet.com. If you're enjoying the show and want to give us a little Christmas present, make sure to leave a review on whatever podcast platform you listen to us on. And thanks for joining us today and all year. We'll talk to you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.